This episode is brought to you by Aircraft Accessories of Oklahoma. When it's time for an aircraft component inspection, overhaul, repair, or replacement, you need experienced technicians you can trust and friendly service you can count on. Aircraft Accessories of Oklahoma, a family-owned business since 1959, delivers just that.
Our techs have real-world experience and provide sales, service, and overhaul for piston engine aircraft accessories. We also have limited turbine capabilities such as fuel pumps, starter generators, and prop governors. And we can overhaul propellers ranging from fixed pitch to turbine. Propeller pickup and delivery service is available. And one more thing, mention this podcast to receive 5% off your next sale, service, or overhaul. Visit aircraftaccessoriesofok.com.
Hi, I'm Mike Bush.
I'm Paul New.
And I'm Colleen Sterling. Welcome to Ask the AMPs from AOPA.
On Ask the AMPs, we try to answer your toughest maintenance questions. So if you have one of those, especially if it's one that like has your mechanic stumped, contact us at podcasts@aopa.org. And we'll try to get you on the show.
Please follow or subscribe to be alerted when a new show comes out.
And if you'd like to get on our email list for our quarterly newsletter and other good stuff, easiest way to do that if you're in North America is to text the word SAVVY, S-A-V-V-Y, to 33777. Again, text the word SAVVY, S-A-V-V-Y, to 33777. And if you're not in North America, that might not work. So then the backup plan is to go to the savvyaviation.com website and click the link up at the very top of the page.
So I have a question, but I need to be a caller, and I'm catching you both off guard so you won't get to study on this one.
Uh-oh.
So, okay, you ready? I need an intro. So
ring,
this
ring.
Is a, wait, what's the, it's going to be.
Our first caller is Paul.
Who's losing pressure.
Who's losing his mind. And has a question.
That
go ahead,
good.
Paul.
All right. So this turbo. Hi, man. I love the podcast. You guys are great.
Is it? Do I start yeah, with whatever.
That? Never miss an episode.
Never miss an episode.
Sure.
And I'm not calling for my airplane, but I am calling with airplanes behind me. So maybe that counts. All right. So this customer brings us a turbo 210, and he's having difficulty in the climb because he's losing manifold pressure at the rate of about 1 inch. Per thousand in the climb.
Very suspicious.
Sounds pretty common. And he, of course, usually when we see an airplane, we're not the first place, we're the kind of the last place that they show up. So turbos have been changed, wastegates have been changed.
Oh, God,
the controller has been sent out. So we get the airplane because they've pressurized, they've actually done all the right things. The things they sent out were sort of we can't find the problem. And we're a little bit desperate and okay, well, we got to try this because we don't have anything else we can do. So the airplane shows up. We pressurize the induction system. We pressurize the upper deck system. We pressurize the exhaust system. We find little leaks in the upper deck, mostly around the manifold pressure gauge, which is inside the cockpit, and the fitting at the firewall. So we take care of that. And I go out to run the airplane to do a flight check. And find out that the manifold pressure gauge is stuck at roughly 29 inches. Can't do anything to make it let loose. Take it out of the airplane, apply vacuum, apply pressure. It won't move. Send it out to have it repaired. Get it back, put it in. Now that works. So I flew the airplane this morning. So this is all good recent stuff. Fresh off the press. At 2,000 feet. Now back up. We borrowed a controller from another airplane. We're not saying any names. We're protecting the guilty here. So we borrowed a controller. We didn't bother to set it up. It was fairly close. At 2,000 feet, I set the manifold pressure at about 32 inches and noted the fuel flow and the manifold pressure and the RPM at 2,000 feet, and then again at 4 and at 6. And then at 7 and, you know, did it in smaller increments going up. And sure enough, it's losing roughly an inch per thousand, and the fuel flow is dropping with the manifold pressure. So I know that it's actually dropping. It's not an indication issue. And on the descent, I lowered the manifold pressure. Well, I leveled off, lowered the manifold pressure, got it to a power setting that was acceptable for a descent, started the descent, and then recorded the manifold pressure after about 1,000 feet of descent because the ram effect was raising the manifold pressure. So once that stabilized, and sure enough, it increases about an inch per thousand. We have pressurized the induction system. We have pressurized the exhaust system. We have pressurized the upper deck system. And I mean, in detail, we've done this a lot of times. And by golly, nothing is showing up. And I am struggling to figure out what else other than the normal leaks. It has to be a control issue because it's not really a critical altitude problem. It's a control issue, it seems like to me, because I can push the throttle in and get more manifold pressure. So the wastegate's not stuck. When I get to 8,000 feet, I can push the throttle in, manifold pressure comes, you know, right up to red line, that kind of thing. So I'm trying to think of any other troubleshooting thoughts to figure this thing out. This is just driving me nuts. Unless
how did you conclude that the wastegate is not stuck?
Because I can manipulate it and get different manifold pressures above ambient at altitude. So at takeoff, it's regulating at about 36, 37 inches. And as I climb, I can add or take away manifold pressure in that climb with the throttle above ambient.
That doesn't prove anything, right?
Yeah, it feels to me like that. If it's above ambient,
it's a manual wastegate.
No, just imagine that the wastegate was capable of closing 2/3 of the way, but it couldn't close any further than that because of some mechanical problem. So it would look perfectly fine on the ground because at full takeoff power, the wastegate isn't anywhere close to all the way closed. It only gets all the way closed when you're up at 25,000 feet at critical altitude.
So it's leaking, basically. It's got a leak.
No, I'm not saying that.
What if
the wastegate, because of a problem with the wastegate itself or with a problem with the wastegate actuator, was just not capable of closing all the way?
So I know that the wastegate has been...
Did you try to exercise it with shop air and stuff and make sure that it runs through its entire range?
Yeah, it's functioning on the ground in the shop. That's been tested. We can double check that again just to be sure, but that's been tested with shop air. It closes at about 45 PSI, which is about normal, 40 to 45. But I have to think through this process of in flight. If I'm manipulating the throttle and it's at 32 inches, which is definitely above ambient at 6,000 feet. If the manifold pressure, I'm changing the throttle.
Let me make a suggestion, Paul.
Okay.
This could be a problem with a leak, although you have diligently tried to find a leak and haven't found anything significant. It would have to be a huge, huge leak.
No, it doesn't take much.
Yeah. Huh? What do you mean it doesn't take much?
It doesn't take much of a leak in the upper deck to allow it to reference the outside air as opposed to upper deck pressure.
No, I'm saying in order to lose an inch of manifold pressure per 1,000 feet, you need a pretty good size leak.
Well, I've never actually quantified how big of a leak it takes, but yeah, so we'll accept that for troubleshooting. And we've pressurized everything.
So what I was about to suggest is to simply cap off the oil line at the controller, take the entire control system out. The minute you have oil pressure, the wastegate should fully close and should just stay fully closed. And then obviously you can't go to full throttle because you're going to
blow cylinders out the cowling.
No, you're just going to pop the overpressure relief valve.
Right.
But take the whole control system out and just test the turbocharger and the intake and exhaust and stuff without any control stuff in the system.
You mean on the ground at sea level?
No, go fly it.
Oh, go fly it?
Yeah, it's just, you turned it into a fixed wastegate.
Yeah.
Engine. Where
I've
where
done that a lot of times when we have critical altitude issues.
Yeah.
Making sure the wastegate's fully closed.
But, I mean, you need to get the first branch of the troubleshooting tree, which is to say, is this a control problem or is this a leak problem?
Right. Well, and that's where we're, that's exactly where we are.
Yeah, that's where you're headed, right?
Because that's where we're heading.
Leaks, so.
We've checked for the leaks, but it feels like a control problem. And that's, you know, we can do that. And we've talked about doing that. That's sort of a, not really a last chance thing, but it's a pretty risky thing to do because you have to be so careful with the throttle. Because with the wastegate fully closed, the manifold pressure runs up so fast, you're very much at a part throttle position on the 210.
Well, certainly
it'll do it.
But that's no different than any fixed wastegate engine, and you have an overpressure relief valve, so you shouldn't even be able to hurt anything if you tried.
Oh, you haven't seen me.
No, I mean, the overpressure relief valve should pop off when the thing is 4 inches over red line or something.
Look, not I agree, and engine. I've popped those before, so I know exactly what that sounds like.
That's why he's afraid.
But as skillful a pilot as you are, Paul, I'm sure you won't pop it. You'll...
Yeah, I mean, and I've done it before. That's not the thing. It's
but I mean, if you basically hardwire the wastegate all the way closed, you ought to be able to take that thing up to critical altitude and pass a critical altitude test. And that if you can do that, that will verify that there are no significant leaks in the system. If you can't do that, you've proved that there are leaks, and you just haven't found them yet.
So. Next question, back to seeing the wastegate move in normal operation and have some confidence that the wastegate is being controlled in flight without capping this off. Just say we're flying and we're at some given altitude. Obviously, if we climb to altitude and the wastegate is closing, we still make manifold pressure on the way up. But is manipulating the throttle, is there any way to differentiate giving a power change due to the butterfly valve or the valve in the throttle body moving versus the wastegate moving? Because when you move the throttle, both of those move. You see what I'm saying?
No, normal this flight. This is a T210, not a P210, right?
Yeah, it's a T210.
And a T210 has an absolute pressure controller, correct?
Yes.
So moving the throttle has no effect on the wastegate position. The wastegate is always trying to generate an upper deck pressure of about 38 or 39 inches, a couple inches over red line.
Mm-hmm.
No matter whether you're throttled back to idle or whether you're
right
balls to the wall, it's always trying its best to maintain a constant upper deck pressure.
All right, our first question is from Grant, who finds that his engine has sprung a leak. What's your story, Grant? Sounds interesting.
Hi, good afternoon, guys. Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it, and I love the show. So I have a 1967 Mooney M20F. I've owned it for a year and a half, maybe a little more. Engine has about 1,200 since major, but the engine was done quite a long time ago. This last October, after a short flight, I noticed just a little bit of oil overspray on the windshield. I cleaned it off. And a few days later, I took about a two-hour flight with my wife to a local fly-in. On the way back, about 15 minutes out from our home, I noticed the windshield getting a little bit blurry. Kind of had a suspicion of what that was. Once we got down, I cleaned it off. A couple days later, I went and talked to my mechanic. And the mechanic said that it was most likely coming from a case bolt, based on the evidence that he saw, which I was happy because I was afraid it was going to be the prop, which only has about 200 hours since new. And he said that he retorqued the case bolt, said go ahead and fly it and see if that solved the problem. I didn't really expect it to solve the problem. And of course it didn't. And he said that the proper way to fix it was to split the case and redo the silk thread, which I'm not going to split the case right now.
That would fix it, but that's not the proper way.
But not because you fixed the thread.
Yeah.
So he said that there is a procedure from Lycoming to, I guess, slow it down, not necessarily repair. But he didn't really say much about what the procedure is. I took the plane down for a couple months for an avionics upgrade. And of course, on the way home, I still had just a little bit of oil spray on the windshield and just a little bit on the very front of the cowling. So I'm curious as to what you guys would recommend. I don't yet have an engine monitor, but I will. I've committed to doing that this next year.
That's not going to fix your oil.
That's a good thing, but it's not going to help you with oil leaks.
And had you not mentioned it, we wouldn't have had to give you the sermon about an engine monitor.
We still like you, though, Grant.
He said that in order to preempt to us from giving you the sermon.
Yeah.
I'm a faithful listener of the show, so I know.
Well, so first off, this isn't your crankcase, and that's not going to fix it. Almost every time, I could be wrong, it's either the crankshaft seal or the O-ring on the propeller. And you're going to fix both of them at the same time. So you take the propeller off, get a new O-ring, and put it inside the hub of the propeller, and it may cost you $8, maybe.
Don't go
like
to
that.
Harbor Freight.
Plus the labor for removing
including labor. Right. And then the crankshaft seal, which unfortunately on a Lycoming is glued in place, and on a Continental it's glued, but there's also a couple of plates that hold it there. And this takes a little bit more effort. And if your mechanic isn't thinking crankshaft seal right off the bat, she may not have ever replaced one before. You can get a solid crankshaft seal, which is what you want, or you can get a split crankshaft seal, which is not what you... I love it. Colleen's over there.
I just did this. I just did this 2 weeks ago.
Tell him how to do it then.
My Lancer, I have a great video showing... We brought in a mechanic that's a friend because he does them every day, and I wanted to make sure I didn't have to take the prop off twice. But the prop was off already to do a swap to a new prop. And I was getting the spray on the windshield, and I noticed it on my clean airplane, and I knew exactly what it was. So he took the old seal out. It sits in the hollow crankshaft. He picked the old seal out, and then he cleaned it very carefully because you use Loctite, some kind of Loctite sealant to put the new crankshaft seal in. Once he cleaned it, he got the old crankshaft seal, the new one. It has a groove with a spring in it. You take the spring out and you unhook or unscrew the spring, take the spring out, you grease this thing up and you heat it. He heated it in some hot oil so it got warm and happy.
Yep.
And then
there's a tool for that.
Well, he didn't use the tool. He used push rods, and he put a screwdriver through one of the holes in the crankshaft where the prop bolts through. And then he looped the crankshaft seal over. And basically what you do is you take this little tiny crankshaft seal that's maybe 4 inches in diameter, and you make it 8 inches in diameter so it can slip over your crankshaft flange.
I say
it's just like childbirth when I see this happen. And I've seen, and it's amazing to me, but just like childbirth, it works. You use these two push rods, which are very smooth, polished rods that are engine parts, basically. And you just kind of squeeze it over and it expands over the crankshaft and snaps into place behind the crankshaft flange. And then you reinstall the little spring and make sure to put it on so that the groove is facing the aircraft. Right. You reinstall the spring, and then you slather it with some of this Loctite and you tuck it into the recesses there, and you're done, basically. And that's what seals the crankshaft. It seals the oil in the engine so it doesn't escape out behind your propeller.
Around the nose bearing on the crankshaft is where
it is like a 10-minute job. The hardest thing was reattaching the little spring because you have to get your fingers back there and it's kind of tight. I guess most of the times you install these things when the case is split, and it's really easy because, you know, you don't have very tight space back there because the case halves are not attached to the crankshaft.
Well, you actually put the seal on after the case halves are assembled.
When they put the seal on at the factory, they do it exactly the same way that you just described. It has to have to stretch it over the
It's just
as difficult.
Well,
you always have to stretch it.
Yeah. But the spring is still, it's still going to be just as hard to do the spring.
Before you put the case halves together?
Well, that's what I'm saying. You can't do it before you put the case halves together.
You can
this
attach.
Is all done. Well, you can hang the spring on there. But
that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. You're not going to do it that way.
Anyway, but it took the guy 10 minutes to do. And it's just once you've seen it done, you're like, oh, that's easy, you know. And the seal cost $10, $20 from Aircraft Spruce. So it's very simple to do.
You know, by the way, like homings are not put together with silk thread.
Mine was. What are you talking about?
The case halves, you know, double-aught silk thread. For the seal between the case halves,
right? The new light, the newest light combing guidance.
Oh,
is
well.
for using a sealant and not using okay. silk.
Well,
thread.
The silk thread yeah. works just fine.
The
if
silk
it's
thread
done right.
works if you put it on right.
Well, silk thread is the traditional old-fashioned cool. way of doing it, and still the way Continentals are put together with silk
so
thread.
So, isn't it possible that he does have a through bolt that's leaking?
Well, he probably does, but it's not putting out enough oil to get on the windshield and. And it takes the force of the propeller spinning because the oil comes off the crankshaft. It's actually exiting the flange of the crankshaft. That's how it gets on the cowling in those little bitty bits. Oil coming off the crankcase is not dribbling out in little bitty pellets or little bitty droplets. It's just oozing out. It's hanging out on the engine. It's not going anywhere. It may get in the cowling, but it's not going to end up on your windshield. It has to be slung off.
It sounded like the A&P was saying, I think it's coming from a through bolt, not that he knows it is. And I certainly wouldn't presume that it was without proving it. I mean, you could wash the engine down real good and then you could spray some dipen developer in the area and then run the engine and see if there's any sign of oil getting on the dipen developer. But
even if it was leaking from the bolt, that oil doesn't make it to the windshield in little droplets.
Okay, yeah. It's most likely a crankshaft seal.
It's almost, yeah. I mean, I've seen a lot of leaks on engines, and they don't make it to the windshield in that fine mist or on the front of the cowling in that fine mist. That comes off the crankshaft. That's just been my experience. Don't split the case halves.
Yeah, I don't want to do that. I've been there, done that. So is this something that you would recommend doing ASAP?
No, there's no hurry.
It's just an inconvenience. It's not going to blow out.
Yeah.
But do it soon.
You can carry a rag until you're ready to do it.
Yeah.
And when the prop's off, Grant, you should replace the alternator belt at the same time.
Yes, good point.
It's just a good time to do that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And as Paul was saying, that there's also a critical O-ring that seals the prop to the prop flange. And if the prop is off, you might as well replace that O-ring as well.
Yeah, and clean the sludge out of your crankshaft. Yeah,
clean the sludge out of the crankshaft.
You'll find all kinds of junk in there.
Yeah.
Nasty.
This is going to be half a day job.
It's fun, yeah. though. It's therapeutic.
It's a cool thing
and
to
then
do.
You get to wire the prop back on, which is always
yeah.
fun,
Ooh,
too.
Ooh, safety wiring.
Safety wiring.
Yeah, that's the job. That is the job to get it
but
right.
But it's not rocket science. It's just, you know, patient work, and you might find it interesting.
So why do light combings require the prop bolts to be safety wired when Continental uses self-locking?
I don't know.
I don't know. That makes no sense to me.
The safety wire is just like a full employment act for mechanics.
Well, the basic way that they attach the light combing, you basically have a bolt or a stud that's built into the propeller.
Mm-hmm.
And so the nut is built in. It's a part
attached
of the flange.
Of the bolt. Yeah.
And that never changes. So they don't have any locking mechanism at all.
But do they?
But
come
I agree.
Off?
The Continental is so much easier to deal with.
Mm-hmm. And I've always been taught that it's supposed to be the heavy safety wire. Is it 42, 41,000?
Well, it depends. So generally speaking, if it's a two blade prop, it's going to be 40,000. If it's a three-blade propeller, you want to go look in the Hartzell or the Macaulay manual and find out because some of them allow for 32,000s.
So I asked Jim Rust because the prop had been wired with 32,000s, and he said 32,000s is fine for this prop. He told me don't wrestle with the 40,000s, which hurts my hands just thinking about it.
Yeah, it's a real pain to do.
definitely going to be blood
back
on
in the
propeller.
Day, Santa Maria Airport, where I'm based, used to be an Aerostar. The Aerostar factory used to be there, and then after that, there was a lot of Aerostar maintenance done there. And man, safety wiring both props on an Aerostar, that was like a major endeavor.
Well, I can tell you, as a my dad was a real Mooney fan, and we had a 1967 M20F. It was the airplane that Mooney used to certify the Century 3 autopilot and the electric landing gear, which came out in, 1970? And so, and this was a real special airplane. It's a lot of fun and all that. But I can tell you, you will spend more time removing the cowling and putting it back on than you will taking the propeller off and putting it back on and the safety wiring. So just be prepared.
Can I ask one quick question, Paul? If he does have a weeping bolt on the case half, isn't there a procedure where you can draw some, clean it, put Loctite on, and then draw a vacuum inside the engine and pull the Loctite in and seal it to some extent?
I have never done that. I have never seen that in print. And it scares me to death to think about the possibilities
of getting it in the case. Yeah.
Because on the top of the, especially you're talking about the top of the engine, and if you look at that, well, you've seen that your crankcase, when it's split, your camshaft rides in the top. And where that thread goes, it comes real close to where the crank, the camshaft bearings, where they're not bearings, they're just the machined out places. So if you're vacuuming sealant into the crankcase, you have no way to know how far the sealant goes. Does it go all the way to those bearings on the camshaft? Does it just suck down into the engine and drip on something? Just not the thing that I would do.
Why not just clean up the area and slather it with some PRC or something?
Yeah. On the outside, that works great.
I've seen that.
Yeah.
not on my engines, but I've seen it. Yeah.
Yeah, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. Just you have to get it perfectly dry, perfectly clean.
Nothing wrong with that unless you're the guy that's going to disassemble the engine next.
Yeah, you know, we're not worried about him.
Although I heard tell that if somebody does that, the way you get it off is with a heat gun. Somebody said if you heat it all up with a heat gun, it comes
Doesn't
off.
The engine
it
get
comes
hot
off
enough?
A lot easier. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, or plastic putty knives will scrape it off.
Mm.
Anyway, Grant's not worried about that.
Small tactical
change your crankshaft seal,
weapons.
Grant. You got it.
At 1,200 hours, he's got couple of thousand hours worth of flying.
He's got at least another 4,000 hours on that engine.
Yeah,
right?
He's not going to be worried about splitting the case halves.
Yeah,
I appreciate the encouragement.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Well, I'm glad we solved that problem.
Yeah, find someone that's done this before so they will get it done right. Gluing that seal back in place, like Colleen was talking about, it needs to be done very specifically so that it will stick.
And there's a service bulletin that describes this whole thing. I don't have the number handy, but I can give the information to Ian. He can put it at the show notes along with maybe even the video if he wants to take that. Okay.
That would be appreciated. I do have a mechanic, or I know of a mechanic on the field that has actually done this on a friend of mine's Mooney in the last year. So.
Perfect.
Yeah, it's pretty common. Yeah.
Yeah. This will take care of the problem.
Awesome. Awesome.
Easy fix. Okay. Well, thanks for the question, Grant. Good one.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. See you guys.
See ya. Our next question is from Joe, whose kids are turning into icicles, which is a common theme that I experienced back in the day.
Yeah.
What's up?
When you were a kid, Paul?
When I was a kid, and my kids experienced it. So I don't want to admit this, but I'm going to. But I got to sit in the luggage compartment of a Tri-Pacer as a six-year-old. That was my spot.
With the seatbelt? No.
Oh, well, you know. This,
you know, it was Tennessee.
So it's Joe called. We're going to talk to Joe.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
sorry, Joe.
It's a Piper, but it's not a Tri-Pacer.
Yeah.
Not a Tri-Pacer.
Correct. Yeah. So we recently purchased a 180 this last fall so I could finish up my commercial rating in it and kind of get back into flying after quite a few year hiatus.
This is a Cherokee 180? Mm-hmm.
Correct. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And we love taking the kiddos, you know, back and forth to a grandparent's house, but man, it gets awfully cold in the back seat. We've tried a few things. There's some like lightning holes, access holes underneath the seat and underneath the baggage. We've put some speed tape over those, and that's helped, but it is still awfully chilly there in the back seat. And I'm just wondering where all the air is coming from, and if there's anything else we can do to try to eliminate this cold breeze that's coming in from the back.
Oh, wow. It's like Swiss cheese underneath. I'm telling you, underneath the seat of a Cherokee or a Comanche, it's like Swiss cheese under there. Well, I'll tell you what we've had to do, because back in the day, we disassembled and reassembled a lot of Cherokees, where the spars come into the cabin, where all the bolts are. There should be two strips of foam, one on the front and on the aft of each spar, right and left, because these are basically holes from the wing root area, the space between the wing root and the cabin, and they're about an inch wide and about 8 inches tall. And so there's four of them. So you stuff foam in there. It's a specific piece of foam. It's a Piper part number.
Got actually a part number, right?
Oh, yeah, okay. It does have a part number. And
I bet they're very proud of that foam too.
They probably are, yeah. So if the wings have ever been off, it's entirely probable that those pieces of foam didn't get replaced. And that'll be a huge amount of air, because it's open to that gap between the cabin and the wing, which there's a fairing, but it's not sealed. So it's high pressure. That's a lot of air coming in.
So do you access that through the wing root fairing, or do you access that from inside the cabin?
Oh, from inside the cabin. So you lift
under the floorboards?
The floorboard comes up, and you can get to it from the backside, also where the carpet drapes over the front of the spar carry through. So it's a box spar inside the cabin. You pull that carpet up, and there's big access holes. Now, that doesn't mean they're easy to get into. It just means that the holes are big. And you see that space where the two wings come in and are bolted in place. There's a bunch of bolts on top of the spar and on the bottom. And you can look in there with a flashlight and a mirror and see if there's the foam that's stuffed in there. If there isn't, get some and stuff it in, and that will help. And then the back end, where the rear spar carry through is, there's a bulkhead where the wing attaches, the trailing edge of the wing attaches. And there are holes there where all the flight control cables and all those things come through. And there should be some like rubber pieces glued with little holes or slots for the cables to pass through.
Like grommets?
Yeah, like grommets, yeah. But it's flat pieces of leather or rubber that's actually glued onto that carry-through spar. And you get those done, and you'll be in pretty good shape.
And that would be in addition to, you know, there's that kind of weather stripping between the wing and the fuselage.
Yes. Yeah, between the wing and the fuselage, that rubber strip that goes around, yeah, I mean, that should be in good shape as well. But even if that's not on the airplane, if you have the foam pieces that go in where the spar comes through, where the cables go through, oh, and the flaps, the torque tube where the flap goes out to the wing, the flap torque tube, that should have a seal around it as well.
Okay.
Now, Paul, to replace that rubber strip you were talking about where the control cables come through, they're basically like cable seals. But you would have to disconnect the control cables in order to replace that?
No, so the hole, and I have to confess, I haven't been in a Cherokee in a long time, but the holes through the spar are probably 4 inches in diameter. And so this leather piece would be 5 inches in diameter, maybe six. And you just cut a slot.
Okay. I see.
And you just slide it in and glue it in place.
Okay, got it.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Well, we will definitely take the back seat out and look for those.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Is it, let's see, 62. Does that have the battery underneath the seat too?
The battery on this is located just aft of the baggage.
Baggage area, right. Okay. Yeah. They moved them underneath the seat in later models. Anyway, yeah, it's not hard once you kind of get an idea.
You take out the rear seat, you pull up the rear floorboards, and you can get to see everything from
there. Everything. It's easy to get to. And once you get in there and you look inside that spar, that box spar that goes from left to right wing, I think that's where you're going to find most of your problem.
That's the main spar carry through.
Yep,
main spar carry through. With the foam.
Yep.
Probably keep the back of your head warmer too, Joe.
Yeah.
I have, well, the front's nice and warm, but I've noticed if I don't have the kiddos in the back seat, feel this really cold breeze on the back of your shoulders.
Yeah. So there's also the air that comes in from the back wall behind the baggage area. And if you get that sealed up, then it's everything's underneath the seat. Once it's, when a Cherokee has all the original pieces in place, it feels good in there.
I'm sure over time, all the original pieces are long gone.
or dry rotted away. Or if the wings came off for any of the most recent AD inspections or any of that kind of stuff, that's the kind of thing people say, oh, we don't need this. Or, you know.
Or this looks like it's in really bad shape. I don't think we're going to put it back.
Right, yeah.
Well, that should help out a lot. I really appreciate your help.
Yeah, it's a great airplane. The 180 is a nice airplane.
It's fantastic. It's a great trainer. It handles fantastic. It's pretty easy on the maintenance. It's been great. It's not super fast, but that's okay because I'm building time anyway.
Yeah, you're not in a hurry. The family may be in a hurry, but you're not in a hurry.
And just that's an 0360 Lycoming with a fixed pitch prop on a Cherokee 180.
Yeah, this one has the 360 A3A.
A3A. That's a great engine.
Bulletproof engine.
The whole thing is pretty simple.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So just tell them you're still going twice as fast as a car.
That's right.
Yeah. Just about.
Well, it turns a 4-hour drive to Grandpa's house into an hour and a half flight, you know. Yeah. So it's fantastic.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That is great. Yep. Yeah,
we'll get those kids warm. In the plans. Yeah,
well,
it's the blankets and coats right now. But
so plus it's so much classier to arrive by air than
by plane.
Yeah, that's cool. Oh yeah, and just imagine once you get all these air leaks resolved, then the financial officer will be so much happier about releasing funds for the engine monitor.
She doesn't like to fly anyway. She's happy. She gets airsick. So that's okay. She's happy that I take the boys and leave. Give her some quiet time. So she's like, oh, you want to go flying with the boys? Sure. Yeah. Fine. Take them all day long. Sounds good.
Go see grandpa for three days.
3 days.
Yep. Yeah, she's totally fine with that.
Do we get extra pay for marital counseling?
Yes, no. We do.
I actually think we're supposed to be licensed to do that.
We'll collect it later.
Oh, okay. Well, then we just give it for free.
Good.
Well, thanks, Joe. Yeah, appreciate it.
Good call, Joe. Thank you.
Thanks.
Our next question is from Todd, who is wondering where that horsepower number comes from. Go ahead, Todd.
Hi, team. My name is Todd Boyland, and I have a 1980 Beechcraft Bonanza A36TC. And I just want to thank you guys individually for the work you do on the podcast, for having me on. I appreciate everything you do for the community. And Mike, for you and your team, I'm a savvy analysis pro customer and appreciate everything you guys do for advancing engine metrics and data analysis. So thank you guys for all you do. For my question, I have a JPI EDM 930 installed in my A36TC. I'm just curious as to how the percent horsepower is derived. I'm assuming it's calculated, but not 100% sure. And wondering if you guys can speak to how it's derived and what you might expect to see from this readout during different partial power loss scenarios.
Well, it is calculated. And exactly how it is calculated is a deep, dark secret that JPI doesn't make public. But I can tell you how we calculate percent power and what I think the correct way to do it is the power output of an engine is either a function of mass airflow through the engine or fuel flow through the engine, depending on whether it's operating rigid peak or lean a peak. The engine operates in two fundamentally different modes depending on the mixture. If you're operating rigid peak, the easiest way to think about this is that whichever is in shortest supply, air or fuel, is what regulates power. So if you're operating rigid peak, then by definition, you've got more fuel than the engine can consume or can actually combust. And so air is in short supply. And so what regulates engine power when the engine is operating rich at peak is mass airflow through the engine. Basically, how many pounds of air per unit of time is going through the engine. And mass airflow is determined, it can be calculated by looking at two things, manifold pressure and RPM. Manifold pressure determines how much air gets stuffed in a cylinder every time the exhaust, the intake valve opens. And RPM determines how often it gets stuffed. So basically, if you multiply the two together, how much gets stuffed and how often it gets stuffed, you get mass airflow through the engine. So power, when you're operating rich at peak, can basically be computed essentially by, at least closely approximated by, multiplying manifold pressure times RPM times some fudge factor to make the units come out right. When you're operating lean at peak, it's the opposite situation. When you're operating lean at peak, you've got more airflow through the engine than you have fuel to be combusted. And so engine power is purely a function of fuel flow. It's very much like a turbine engine, which always operates in that mode, where there's tons of air and it's really fuel flow that determines power. So when you're lean at peak, you can compute power by fuel flow times the fudge factor, and that fudge factor is simply a function of what the compression ratio is. So if it's an 8.5-to-1 compression ratio, the fudge factor is like 14.9. So fuel flow in gallons per hour times 14.9, it gives you horsepower. But that only works when you're lean at peak. So if you're trying to compute horsepower and you don't know whether you're lean at peak or rich at peak, which is probably the case with the engine monitor, it probably doesn't know whether you're lean at peak or rich at peak, then the easy way to do it is to compute it both ways, and whichever comes out with the lowest number is the right one.
Be conservative? Is that what you mean?
No. It basically, if you use the rich at peak formula and your lean at peak, the rich at peak formula will give you a ridiculously high number. But the lean at peak will give you the right number. And that's true the other way around. If you're operating rich at peak and you calculate the two, the lean at peak formula will give you a ridiculously high number. And the rich at peak formula will give you the right number. So if you just compute it both ways and then pick whichever number comes out the lowest as being the correct one, then you are automatically getting it right. So if JPI knew what they were doing, and I can't vouch for whether they do or not, that's how they would compute it. Now, obviously, this assumes that the engine is working properly. I mean, for example, if there was no ignition and the engine was windmilling, it would still be showing manifold pressure and it would still be showing fuel flow. And if you ran the formula, it would be putting out some horsepower, but of course it really isn't, because there's no spark igniting anything. So for it to be correct, the engine has to be basically functioning properly.
And that's what I was getting at. Under, you know, certain partial power loss scenarios, what would you expect?
Right. So my guess is, if you swallowed an exhaust valve or something, you better not assume that the percent power readout on your engine monitor is anywhere near accurate.
So
it doesn't know that you swallowed an exhaust valve.
Mike's trying to say that that's probably not a good measure to use if you have a problem with the engine. I would look at individual cylinders and look at their temperatures and exhaust gas to see how they're operating.
Yeah, I completely agree. The partial loss scenarios are always some of the more scary ones, and I wonder if that would be any clue into a situation, but it's probably not something that can be relied on.
It'd be nice to have a single number like that. That would be easier to interpret.
What would be really nice would be if you had a torque sensor at the junction of the propeller and the crankshaft flange. And we actually looked into that a bit, and it's doable, but the torque sensors are very expensive, and it's also a little tricky to get data from the torque sensor, because it's turning at 2400 RPM. So you either need to have some kind of a wireless arrangement for the torque sensor to transmit data into the engine monitor, or you'd need to have some fancy arrangement of brushes and slip rings or something like that. So it's probably not practical to do torque sensors, but that would actually give you a really accurate indication of how much horsepower the engine's putting out, but we don't have that information.
On the Garmin systems, the G1000, Perspective, Perspective Plus, all those, outside air temperature is also added into the calculation.
Of horsepower?
Yeah, for the horsepower, because if the OAT probe connections are flaky or something, which we see quite common on those, the percent power just red X's or whatever, it goes nuts.
Yeah, OAT so would affect the reach of peak calculation
right.
because mass airflow also is affected by air density.
Air density. So they use that. But in a partial power loss situation, man, percent power is like the last thing on your mind.
Yeah, it's going to yeah. go
If the
go
engine's
completely
running,
wonky.
You're happy. You know, been there a few times, and I can tell you, it's like, I don't care what the percent power is. I feel it. It's going to get me to that airport as opposed to that field. That's what I'm thinking.
Nope. Understood. Great insight. I appreciate you guys' help.
Yeah. Yeah. No, yeah. Interesting question.
Yeah,
I never
question.
Really thought
and
about it.
We would all like to know how they calculate that.
Yeah. Yeah. Trade secrets.
Trade secrets.
All right. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Todd.
All right. Thanks. Take care.
Have
thanks,
fun with
Todd.
That bonanza. Bye-bye.
All right, we got a couple of great letters here that I'd love to read you guys. The first one's from Trevor. He said, I'm a big fan of the podcast. The team is incredibly knowledgeable, and it is great to have the platform to share their knowledge. This is not the question I just
said. They say this because they think that's going to make us give them
us
a better answer.
They're buttering
they say,
us
oh,
up.
But
yeah.
You got it all wrong when you were
now.
Talking
here's,
about...
Here's where the tone changes.
That's well,
here
right.
comes. You ready? One note, you may want to take a deeper look at the comment made in regards to tuned exhaust not adding more stress to the engine. Colleen was right, and Mike was right, depending on how you look at it.
Ooh, I wasn't in there this time. Yay.
Tuned exhaust creates a constant flow, so there's a slight suction due to the momentum of the exhaust right in front of the exhaust port when it closes. This results in more exhaust leaving and then more fresh air coming into the cylinder. The more air, usually oxygen, in the cylinder allows for more fuel to be burned to create more power. More power is more stress. If you ran a tuned exhaust at the same power setting as a non-tuned exhaust, Mike would be correct. If you utilize the additional power, then Colleen is correct.
I thought I was right.
Oh, well, that sounds like what he's saying has to be correct almost by definition.
I love that. I like that. Mike's being congenial. I mean, I thought I was right, but then I, you know, it's hard to stand up against Mike because it's age before beauty.
Ooh,
he's
it.
Got more experience
stick to your
than
guns.
I do.
Well,
but
we're not standing up, Colleen. You said we're both right.
Down.
So, you know, take it and run.
Yeah. Half right.
No,
I like
no,
being
no,
half
no,
right.
No, no. He said we were both right.
Thanks, Trevor. Thank you, Trevor. I owe you one.
Okay, great. This one's from Darwin. This is about the commander that was dieseling at shutdown. You remember
mm-hmm.
that one?
I remember that, yeah.
He said, it's concerning the gentleman out of Mount Pleasant who called about his Rockwell 112 TC dieseling at shutdown. Not long after I purchased my airplane, I had the same problem. After a flight, and more typically on hot days, when shutting down the engine, it would fight or resist stopping after pulling the mixture. I initially checked the mixture rigging to make sure that the lever was moving all the way to the stop, and it was. I then checked my primer. It was very difficult and stiff to move, and I thought maybe the O-rings had gone bad. I removed it, cleaned it, installed new O-rings, and it now works very easily and smoothly, but had no effect on my shutdown issue.
That is a good call, though.
Yeah. My mind then began thinking about a carburetor problem, and I asked my brother about it since he has much more experience with general aviation than I. The first question he asked me was if I was at idle when shutting down the engine, which I was. He told me to set the RPM to 1,000 before moving the mixture to cutoff and see what happens. He said this is typically stops the quote run-on issue. And if it didn't fix the issue, then there was definitely an internal carburetor problem. I tried it and it worked and has worked every time since without fail.
That's because to shut the engine off, you don't have to stop the fuel. You just have to stop enough fuel or get the engine so lean that it doesn't run. So the commander is fuel injected, very different system than a carburetor. So yeah, running it at 1,000, you have a whole lot more air. So when you cut off the mixture, it's more likely to stop. but it should shut down at idle.
So there's something wrong with the servo, you think?
Well, he's the carburetor.
Oh,
yeah, this guy's a carburetor. Yeah.
He's carbureted, right.
It is, and I was trying to, when I got the letter, I remember there, I can't remember which airplane it was now, but there are a few actually that in the shutdown checklist do mention going to 1,000 RPM first.
Yes, I've seen that on
the checklist. Yeah, before you blow the mixture. And I wondered if that was why.
So I hear that, and I wonder sometimes if that's not a way just to clear the lead fouling from the spark plugs before you shut down. That's a pretty common practice.
It's a long taxi, yeah.
But most engines will shut down at idle with the mixture control. And if they don't, then I don't know that you need to attack it with tools, but you may have a float that's partially sunk. So you've got fuel at too high a level. So you've got a much richer mixture. I have to think through all that, but I don't know that I would fix anything.
And this was a Commander 114 or something?
Well, the Commander is the one, the question that we answered on the caller.
The Commander is injected, right?
Right, but this guy's talking about his carbureted engine.
Okay, yeah, if the injected one, you won't shut down. It's normally the right. Flow divider.
The flow divider spring, yeah, shuts off.
Right. We probably said that.
But this being a carburetor.
It would have something to do with the float.
The float.
And the needle valve, the float operates.
Right. Mm. Our next question is from Seth, whose wheels are spinning. And we'll see what that means.
The wheel goes round and round.
Wheels on the bus.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Seth. I'm sorry.
I just want to thank you guys for this podcast. Thanks for taking my question. I fly a 182 and I tie it down. Mainly it's for commuting, but I do use it for pleasure as well. And recently I've determined my tires needed attention as there's been signs of dry rot appearing. So I've received some differing opinion on when it's time after talking to my mechanic. At the point of dry rot, that is when it's time in his opinion. And then I spoke to Desser and got a little different opinion on it, that if the cord is showing and the tread is worn down, that's when it's time. Dry rot, not necessarily a time to replace. So what say you fine folks?
I vote for Desser.
For Desser.
We're still using tube-type tires in almost all general aviation aircraft. I think there are a few exceptions, but... And so the tire itself doesn't have to be airtight. It's the tube that contains the...
The tire has to be viable, has to stay together.
And the viability of the tire is all in the cord. And I think these are all bias ply tires that we use, and I don't think we use any radials. So unless the cord is exposed, the rubber outside the cord is mostly decorative, you know, other than the tread. And all of the guidance from Goodyear and everything says that there's no minimum tread depth. It's as long as the cord's not showing, the tire is.
You know, years ago, I had an IA that was passing my Cardinal each year, doing the inspection for me, because I do all the work and he'd do the inspection. And he started to get this magnifying glass out. And he was like, you would be amazed at how deep these cracks are in your tires. I think you need to replace them. And I said, well, have you ever looked at the own skin on your hand? I mean, yeah, those things are amazing. But I mean, the point was I went to the Goodyear, you know, site, and I downloaded, it was a Goodyear Flight Custom tire. I downloaded their guidance and it said cracks are fine. It just can't show tread. It has to have, you know, a little bit of tread and can't show any of the banding. So I finally chased him away. I actually talked him down. And the next year I got my IA and said, this is ridiculous. I'm going to do my own inspections.
There you go.
Yeah, it's true.
Now, I guess the exception to that rule, would be if the tire was severely flat spotted because like it locked up on a landing or something like that.
Yeah, but usually it shows cord when you flat spot it.
But yeah, but even if it didn't flat spot quite that far, you probably wouldn't want to deal
you don't
with
like the
tire
thump.
That was that far out around, but
yeah, yeah.
But yeah, the basic rule is if the if the cord isn't showing, then the tire is still airworthy.
And those retreads are great. I put retreads on my plane. I love the Desser retreads. And your mains are maybe showing wear more because you land on them first, right? You shouldn't be landing on your nose gear as much. So that makes total sense, what everything you said about your tires, except that I fly 100 hours a year and grease on 95% of the landings. I was very curious about that.
Those are the flights when he's solo.
Yeah. Do you have data to support that assumption?
You know, it's amazing the contemptuous comments I've received from A&Ps when I recommend using retreads. And they'll say, "You want to use recaps?"
Yeah.
On that Cirrus SR22, are you crazy? You know.
So my husband pointed out that the airlines will—they always retread, and they stamp a number on the sidewall of the tire to show. I guess when they get to four retreads, they have to stop. But
and the retreads meet the TSO.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're same size. Not the monsters.
Was, I don't know. 10 or 15 years ago, there was a comparative test that Aviation Consumer did where they torture tested a whole bunch of different kinds of tires. And the ones that came out the best were the Desser retreads.
The Monster retreads are different though, since you mentioned that you had those. On a retractable airplane, don't use Monster retreads, but standard retreads are perfectly fine. They're standard diameter. There's nothing different about them. So if it's a standard Desser retread, you can use it anywhere. Cirrus, 210.
Yeah, I think the Monster retreads are only available in like 6006s and stuff. I know that when I get retreads for my 310, then you can't get Monster retreads in that size.
Yeah, we had a 210 guy show up and we got the airplane in the hangar and put it on jacks. And as the gear is retracting, we hear these funny sounds and we look back and we see metal bending back at the wheel well. This is a plane that doesn't have gear doors. It's a 79 or 80 model. And sure enough, the tires are making contact. We're like, I don't know why we didn't notice. So we took a couple of pictures, sent it to the owner and said, "Man, you can't have Monster retreads on this airplane." "Well, I just put them on there last week before I brought it to you so it would look good for the inspection." It would look good. So he bought another couple of retreads that are standard size and we swapped them out and he gave the Monster retreads to his 182 hangar mate. But yeah, don't use them on retracts, but everything else is great.
That raises another question. If we're good to go to fly with a little dry rot, being that I'm tying down, it made me wonder, should I be putting covers over my tires with them in the elements here in Southern California? Not real corrosive inland, but we do get the sun. Good heat.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's not a bad idea.
I've seen people do that. They do that with their RVs, right? When they park their RVs outside.
I was thinking that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if it's going to be out there on the ramp, that can't
probably
hurt,
be a good idea to wash the tires off from time to time, too, just to keep the environmental residue down.
What about any type of any kind of tire conditioner that you would recommend?
No, but I put it on.
You mean something like Armor All or something? I don't know.
Yeah, to make them look nice. I do that sometimes.
But in the meantime, keep flying those tires.
Yeah.
Yeah. There you go.
Don't stress out about them being weather checked.
Yeah, they do good.
Very cool.
Thanks for the call,
Seth.
Thank
you for your advice.
Thanks, sure. Seth.
All right. See you all take care.
All right. You too.
Thanks.
Okay, that's it for this episode. Hopefully, we got a couple things right this time. Let us know what we got wrong. Keep sending us your tricky questions. You can email them to podcasts@aopa.org.
See ya.
Bye, everybody.